77% of us admit to using our phones while driving. That's according to a survey from the Travelers Insurance Company last year. The survey goes on. 74% of us use cell phone maps. More than half of us read texts or emails behind the wheel. More than a fourth post or scroll through social media. 1 in 5 admit to online shopping while driving. An estimated 46,000 people died on U.S. highways in 2022. It's unclear how many of those were a result of distracted driving. Our next guest calls distracted driving an epidemic. He's calling for changes to the ways we collect safety data and the ways we look out for each other on the road. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you seen a lot of distracted driving on the road? Will you admit to being one of those many people who did things with their phones while driving just for a quick minute? Have you changed your habits? Has this affected your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bruce Landsberg is the vice chair of the National Transportation Safety Board and is on the steering committee of the National Distracted Driving Coalition. Bruce, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Rob. This is a critically important subject for all of us.
Now, I think we all know distracted driving is pretty dangerous. What you're making the case for in your organization is that the numbers that we might have out there don't really tell the whole story. Why might we be undercounting the impact of distracted driving?
Well, the main reason is that being on the phone doesn't leave a trail. So when someone is in a crash, if they are impaired or if they've been speeding or something like that, there's a trail, if you will, that shows that this is what's going on. Unless the police are able to get a subpoena to look at your phone, or unless the driver says, hey, I was talking or chatting on my phone, we don't have that information, and law enforcement is pretty busy. If it's a fender bender, they don't pay a lot of attention to it because they got other things to do. So we think this is badly undercounted, and right now we're making a best guess estimate that the undercount is probably about 3 times as bad as we think. So a couple of years ago, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration tallied up over 3,400 fatalities nationwide. We think that it's probably closer to about 10,000 fatalities every year. And if you go beyond just fatalities and we go to life-altering injuries, such as burns, amputations, brain damage, et cetera, you're talking hundreds of thousands of people who have had their lives badly altered as a result of a lifestyle choice.
Big picture, Bruce, as I understand the history of traffic safety in the United States, we spent a lot of years getting safer and safer with better road design, safer cars, things like that, and we're actually starting to turn that around. Is that what you're seeing, and how big a factor in that is distracted driving and bending that curve the opposite of the way we'd want it to go?
Well, in various areas, I mean, we've been working on DUI for decades, and the whole concept of just say no hasn't worked with drugs. It hasn't worked with distracted driving or other sorts of impairment. It hasn't worked for speeding very well. And it most certainly doesn't work with personal electronic devices. The devices are basically designed to be addictive. And so people use them. We understand that. So just hoping that people won't use it, as you've seen from some of the data that you cited at the opening of the interview, is that most people are using their phones. And one thing that happened when I came to the NTSB several years ago, they said, we don't use our phones when we're driving, even if it's something critically important. We'll get a hold of you when you get to wherever it is that you're going. And the national trucking companies, such as UPS and Federal Express, they do want to talk to their drivers, but they have a system worked out where they can let the driver know, hey, we want to talk to you. But don't do it while you're driving. Find a safe place in the next 10 or 15 minutes, pull over, and we'll talk about where you need to go next. So there are ways of managing this, but we have to learn to say no. And as individuals, we don't do that very well.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the technological solutions. Are there things that the people who make our phones and their operating systems can do to make it easier for us to say no or to not even think about it, to opt out in the first place?
Well, absolutely. First off, we think that the phones ought to be defaulted to not operating for non-driving activities when the cars are in motion. And the phone knows when the car is in motion. So far, the phone manufacturers have chosen not to do that. You have to opt in and go to your settings and do it that way. And likewise, the telecom companies could be doing something to manage this. And some people say, well, I use my navigation function. We're not talking about that. Or I listen to music. We're not talking about that. We're talking about talking on the phone, texting, as you said, online shopping, and people playing video games. We have investigated crashes where people have been playing video games or have just absolutely not been paying attention, with a very bad outcome for all concerned.
How about the cars themselves? The technology board in front of us keeps getting bigger and more complicated. Is that part of the story?
Well, I think it absolutely is. I saw one car advertisement recently that said, you know, we have a 14-inch screen. Well, where do you think people are going to be looking? And one of the things that science has done for us, they've looked at this very carefully. If you take your eyes off the road for more than about 3 seconds, the chances of being in a crash start to go up. And the longer you're off the road, the more that increases exponentially. So the science is clear. If you're not looking at the road, you are setting yourself up for a bad day.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. John is with us in Algoma. John, hi.
Hi. I have an Apple phone, and it has an application in it, in the operating system, actually, that allows me to have the phone automatically turn off when I'm driving the car. And I know you were talking about technological solutions, but it's a social issue. And my question is whether your guest has any sample or model legislation for state legislatures which would allow them to require that operating systems have such an application and that it be automatically turned on when you turn the car on.
Great question, John. What do we see out there, Bruce?
John, that is a fabulously good question, and the answer is yes. And the NTSB has come up with some model legislation that can be used. Obviously, the federal government does not control the state driving laws, and NTSB, we don't make rules whatsoever. We merely make recommendations. But in the NTSB, carry Apple phones as well, and we have to set them to the default, or I should say the non-default position, so that the phone knows when we're in motion, and it won't buzz at us when we're doing this. So I think that's a great suggestion. If we could get the public to agree to this and to encourage their legislators to vote for it, because the lives you save will be those of your family and friends.
John, thanks for that call. We're talking to Bruce Landsberg, vice chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, part of the National Distracted Driving Coalition, looking at the risks of distracted driving, some possible solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you found ways to maybe boost your willpower and not be distracted by your phone while driving? What kind of things have you seen on the road yourself? If you are in highway law enforcement in some part of it, do you have a story to share about what you've seen out there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Bruce Landsberg, vice chair of the National Transportation Safety Board, also with the National Distracted Driving Coalition, looking at data on distracted driving, why the numbers may be understating the problem. You can join in with your questions for our guest, your own stories or experiences at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Oconomowoc. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you? I think that with all due respect to your guest, it's much too broad an indictment against, quote, the use of cell phones currently. I have a car that's a special interest vehicle, but nonetheless, although it's 10 years old, it was equipped by its manufacturer with an automatic interface for any cell phone that you just clone to it. So anytime I wish to speak to somebody on my cell phone while driving, and I commute back and forth to Chicago at least twice a month, I don't have to do anything except press the microphone button on my steering wheel, which turns around and does everything that I would like it to do, including navigational guidance, et cetera, et cetera. What difference is there in the distinction your guest makes between A, using hands-free cell phone conversation for whatever purpose it may be? This is not game playing or a big screen that you're interacting with. It's simply totally hands-free microphone conversation. What's the difference between that and speaking to a passenger in your car on a long trip?
Tom, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Bruce, hands-free use of cell phones.
Great question, Tom. Thank you. So the academics in the group have done some study with simulators, and they find that hands-free is in fact better than manipulating the phone, which I'm sure you would agree with. The problem comes in with the fact that you are cognitively distracted. And that sounds, you know, that's a 60-cent word, for you're not devoting 100% of your attention to the driving task. And once again, the statistics seem to show that this is a problem. And one of the challenges we have is the idea that the driving environment is tremendously dynamic. And if you're in a high density traffic environment, it can be a real problem where things will change literally within seconds. And if you happen to be thinking about what you're going to say on the next part of the discussion, you may be putting yourself at a disadvantage. How is it different than talking to a passenger? It's not much different than talking to a passenger, but once again, you have total control over that situation as opposed to saying to somebody else, hey, wait, I've got a deal coming up here. The passenger can see what's going on. I'm pretty sure that, you know, a lot of people are not as responsible as you are in the use of your phone. And once again, we're seeing that. To help put this in context, in the aviation industry, we've been coming under a microscope recently, and we haven't had, there have been two fatalities in the last 10 years in scheduled airline flights. We are killing the equivalent of approximately one airliner every single week on the highways from what we estimate is due to distracted driving. Is that acceptable? That's a rhetorical question. I don't think so.
Thanks a lot for that call, Tom. Bruce, I want to bring us back to our starting point. Are there things we can do to collect data better so we can get a grasp on how big a problem distracted driving is?
Yeah, I think there are. And that would be, again, there are companies called telematics, or that's the general descriptive term, that can track these kinds of things. And there are apps that you can put on your phone. Some insurance companies are encouraging people to do that. And it gets us to a point of, you know, why are people so hooked on this? And why are the phone companies so hooked on it? It all comes down to economics. There's a lot of money to be made when people are online, whether they're driving or otherwise. And so, you know, we look at this and we say, well, I'm not going to have a crash. I've never had a crash. I'm not going to. That's what we refer to as optimism bias. And we're not very good at self-assessing how well we do. And I guess one of the key points, Rob, is every single person that was involved in a distracted driving crash, when they got in their car, was absolutely certain that it wasn't going to happen to them. And it's hard for us to get through that mindset because it's hardwired into every one of us.
Time for one more quick call from Cyril in Madison. Cyril, hi.
Hi, Rob. I just wanted to bring up an issue regarding the engineering and the software that's going into all these modern vehicles now. You have automatic emergency braking. You have blind spot warning. You have lane departure warning. You have lane keeping assistance.
I gotcha, sir. We don't have a lot of time left. But Bruce, are these part of the solution, those things that slow you down when the car in front of you slows down?
Absolutely. We're a big belief in the driver-assisted equipment. We're a long ways yet, though, from the fully automated vehicles that you hear so much about. Until we get to being fully automated, I think we're going to have to be really careful about how we divert our attention from the roads.
Thanks for that call, Cyril. And Bruce, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you. And everybody, please, the call can wait. Get to your destination.
That's Bruce Landsberg, vice chair of the National Transportation Safety Board and part of the National Distracted Driving Coalition. He joined us today with a look at distracted driving and possible solutions. You can keep sharing your thoughts over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Wisconsin voters will choose a new state Supreme Court justice next month with the ideological lean of the court hanging in the balance. The new court will be asked to weigh in on any number of hot-button issues, including the state's abortion ban. But it could also consider a challenge to the state's political district maps, which have been called among the most gerrymandered in the nation. As Bridget Bowden reports, it has the potential to shape the state's political landscape for years to come.
In statewide elections in Wisconsin, sometimes Republicans win. Sometimes it's Democrats. But when it comes to which party controls the legislature, it's never close. With the help of the redistricting plan they first drew more than a decade ago, Republicans win every time. In 2015, Wisconsin Democrats thought they had the answer to this, a new standard to measure gerrymandering that would give federal courts the ability to decide when maps were too partisan. They took the idea all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the day they made their arguments, it was obvious that some of the justices weren't ready to go there.
And it may be simply my educational background, but I can only describe a sociological gobbledygook.
A couple years later, the Supreme Court slammed the door to the idea that partisan gerrymandering could be solved in federal courts. But according to University of Wisconsin-Madison law professor and redistricting expert Rob Yablon, that wasn't the end of the road.
The court in that decision explicitly left the door open for state courts to consider partisan gerrymandering claims under their own state constitutions.
And that's why the maps are a huge issue in this year's race for an open seat on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, where liberal Milwaukee County Judge Janet Protasiewicz is facing conservative former Justice Dan Kelly. If Protasiewicz wins, it would flip the ideology of the court for the first time since 2008. And that could be big for Wisconsin's maps, Yablon says, because someone could challenge them in court.
I have little doubt that if the court's composition changes, someone is going to try to pursue that case.
The state's current maps were drawn by Republican legislators in 2021. They were based on maps that Republicans drew 10 years before. In that time, the GOP has held strong control of both houses of the legislature, even in years when Democrats did well in statewide elections. Yablon says different maps might change that.
If the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted new maps, those maps would by no means guarantee that the Democrats would take control of the legislature, but it would at least raise the possibility that there would be a meaningful fight for legislative control.
That could open the door to any number of policy changes that Democrats haven't been able to pursue in recent history, like expanding Medicaid, legalizing marijuana, and codifying abortion rights. Protasiewicz, the candidate backed by Democrats, says she'd like to take a fresh look at the maps.
So let's be clear here. The maps are rigged, bottom line. Absolutely, positively rigged. They do not reflect the people in this state.
Protasiewicz stops short of saying how she would rule in a redistricting lawsuit, saying she's merely expressing her values. Kelly, the candidate backed by Republicans, takes issue with that.
I think when someone tells you what their values are in answer to a legal question, they're telling you how they're going to decide a case.
He defends the maps and says personal values shouldn't come into play when deciding a legal question. Rick Essenberg is the president of the conservative Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. He says even if a map challenge were to be brought before the state Supreme Court, he doubts a violation of the Wisconsin Constitution could be proven.
The problem is that there really isn't anything in the Wisconsin Constitution other than a requirement that the maps be contiguous and compact. And the thing about the maps in Wisconsin is that they are contiguous and compact.
But Jeff Mandel, board president of the liberal group Law Forward, believes there are provisions in the Wisconsin Constitution that the maps violate. He says there's no hard and fast plan for how to challenge the maps yet.
But there are plenty of conversations going on about what such a lawsuit would look like, who would be included, what claims it would make, and how it would proceed.
If the court flips, he says it's likely a challenge is filed pretty quickly. The new justice will be seated on August 1st. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
On a related note, join us tonight at 7 for a rebroadcast of this week's Wisconsin Supreme Court candidate debate. Former Supreme Court Justice Dan Kelly and Judge Janet Protasiewicz participated in the State Bar of Wisconsin's candidate debate yesterday. You can hear that rebroadcast again. That's tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio, or stream it at WPR.org.